Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Annika Smith with the Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, and today I'm privileged to have with me on the show author and Discovery Institute fellow Nancy Piercy, one of our few female fellows here at Discovery, and a thinker, moral philosopher, and writer of the highest order. Nancy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Annika. I appreciate it.
Now, your book, Saving Leonardo, is in the news a little bit here and doing quite well for itself. And it documents secularism's rise and effects in our world. Our own J.P. Moreland called it a tour de force. And I like to tell my friends that it's sort of a history of worldviews and how they play out in our culture. Would that be accurate?
That's exactly right. In some ways, I like to think of it as what Philip Johnson used to call the second wedge. A lot of people talk about the wedge strategy, and that's become a controversial term because people don't know what it means. But what it simply means is that science has been so interwoven with philosophy that many people can no longer tell them apart. So people often think that to be scientific means you have to embrace philosophies like materialism or naturalism. And the wedge strategy is just prying those two apart so that you can see that what science really requires of us and what philosophy has gotten interwoven with it. And the second wedge was taking the same approach and applying it to the culture, saying, look at how these philosophies now permeate down through the culture as well, to art and literature, movies and music. In many ways, artists are the ones who take what the scientists and philosophers say and spit it out for ordinary people. Make it into stories, make it into images so that ordinary people understand those ideas. They, in a sense, create a world that the scientists describe and show people what it means to live inside that world. So in many ways, the Saving Leonardo was about taking that next step and seeing how ideas permeate through a culture. The culture obviously has much more power for most people. Most people don't get their ideas by going and signing up for philosophy classes at their local university. Most of them get their ideas about life through the books they read and the movies they watch and the music they listen to.
Yeah.
Knowing how to interpret ideas when they come to us, not in words where they're easier to recognize, but through story and image and plot line. These are crucial skills for anyone who wants to be more intentional about communicating with other people and being aware of what's, you know, the direction of our culture. And the evolutionist says, well, hey, wait, we solved that problem. We can explain the evolution of empathy or cooperation or mutual aid or other forms of social bonding because these behaviors are selected for by natural selection because they help secure genetic fitness, they promote survival, they help social groups to cooperate and survive better.
Right.
But the answer to that is, does that really salvage morality then? Does that provide an objective basis for morality, which is the whole point? And the answer is no, because after all, you've just redefined morality in terms of non-moral behavior, like passing on your genes and survival and so on. The explanation of altruism, kindness, for example, is, well, it helps group survival. Well, in that case, it's not moral behavior at all, and this is a well-known logical fallacy. It's called equivocation. It's where you start out with one term, and you end up with another term, and you really haven't explained the first one at all. And even Darwin did this in one of his notebooks. He said that it's our descent, our genetic descent, that is the origin of our evil passions. The devil under the form of the baboon is our grandfather. And what he was saying in a kind of colorful language is that what we call evil is merely our inherited animal passions. So in essence, the evolutionary psychologist is trying to salvage morality by denying that it is genuine morality and by reducing it to just another survival strategy. They've tried to salvage morality by destroying it, which doesn't work.
Right. Well, there's an interesting article which you mentioned in Biology and Philosophy where these philosophers actually argue that Darwinists really should be, which we find some of them are in actuality, complete nihilists. They should be metaphysical nihilists who deny that there's any meaning or purpose in the universe, which I think is what you, when you get that equivocation problem that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think that this article is it's quoted in Saving Leonardo because I think these guys are right on. They are saying that if you start with Darwinian premises, you end up being a nihilist. Nihilism comes coming from the term meaning nothing.
Right.
An ethical nihilist is somebody who denies any intrinsic or objective morality. Why? Why? Well, these two philosophers who wrote the article said morality only makes sense in a world that's imbued with meaning and purpose, because morality is really a way of saying what humans are designed to do. What is their purpose? What is their ultimate goal?
It's completely teleological.
Teleological. What is their telos? What is their ideal state? Well, if there's no designer, then there is no design. Humans are not designed for anything, and there is no purpose. And as a result, there cannot be any genuine morality. And the reason this is so important is, of course, if what we call evil is just a natural product of evolutionary forces, then you cannot really oppose it. There's no logical basis for opposing it. And we will end up not being able to really oppose things like injustice and oppression. And so these ideas don't just stay in the ivory tower. They really affect how people live and function, and that's why they're so urgent.
Absolutely. Now, you write that the reason this is important, as you just touched on, the urgency, because we need morality in order to stand up to injustice. We need an objective basis for telling someone else that they are wrong and stopping oppression. How did Darwin contribute to this model that sees things obviously as non-guided, undirected, and without design and purpose? And how did it degrade human dignity?
Well, you have to realize, I like the term you used, teleological. You have to realize that before Darwin, most people thought nature was teleological. That means, it's from the Greek word telos, which means a thing's goal or purpose or the ideal state towards which it's moving. You know, the egg is going to become a chicken. The acorn is going to become an oak tree. And this goes all the way back to Aristotle, who said these natural processes are good because it brings things to their ideals, their perfect state. This teleological view of nature is what Darwin really put his finger on and tried to get rid of. People began to say, well, you know, isn't the universe a great machine? Doesn't it just run by gears and cogs and everything's, you know, by blind mechanical necessity?
Right.
The living things, of course, were the hardest things to explain merely mechanically because they're the most obviously teleological. Your eyes are made for seeing. Wings are made for flying, to be very simple about it.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the only reasons that molecules are arranged in that particular pattern is to serve a purpose, a function. So that living things were the hardest thing to explain by any purely mechanistic model. And it was Darwin who really provided the final puzzle piece in a mechanistic worldview when he provided a material, purely blind process of natural selection, the random origin of variations, the mechanical process of selection. Both of them would propose specifically to get rid of the concept of purpose or design in biology. And that had profound moral implications, because if nature was not the handiwork of a personal God, then it did not show signs of God's good purposes, and it no longer provided a basis for natural law ethics. This was a huge, huge shift in people's thinking about morality. Now morality was reduced to being just subjective, and nature could no longer be used to support any particular moral perspective.
Now, you mentioned earlier how, and you emphasize frequently in your book, how the artists communicate. They in a sense, translate these ideas into popular culture and in really insidious ways that we don't necessarily recognize immediately. And you have a wonderful chapter on literary naturalism and the movement in the 20th century that really, because of Darwin, changed the way we view other people and our world. You talk about Jack London specifically. Can you share with our listeners what happened to Jack London? You call it a conversion experience when he encountered Darwin.
Yeah, it's funny. I have taught at both the college and the high school level, and virtually every student I've ever had has read books by Jack London, like Call of the Wild. But what most of them don't know is that as a young man, London underwent what one historian called a conversion experience. to radical materialism. It was when he first encountered Darwin's theory of evolution. It's like he was so impressed that he memorized long passages from Darwin. He could quote them by heart. And so even though he was writing about dogs, that was really just to soften the blow. His real message was that humans are nothing but evolved organisms. They have no free will. They're governed by natural selection and survival of the fittest. And this was really the core message of literary naturalism. It was using fiction, novels, poetry, and so on, to flesh out the tenets of philosophical naturalism, which is the idea that humans are just products of nature, naturalism, products of nature, and nothing more. That they're determined by environment, genetics, and so on.
Right.
In fact, one of the other literary naturalists was Theodore Dreiser, and literary naturalism is often summed up with a line from one of his novels, where he says, "The individual is the pawn of forces over which he has no control." So this was a theme that was literary naturalism was particularly big here in America, and they were using fiction to convey this to the public. In fact, Dreiser himself underwent almost the same kind of conversion experience. In his case, he was reading Herbert Spencer, who, of course, was the most influential popularizer of Darwin's theory here in America. The reason he was so popular was because he turned Darwin's theory into an entire worldview. He didn't just talk about the biology. He talked about sociology and psychology and so on. And so, in fact, Dreiser actually says at one point that when he read Spencer, it blew him intellectually to bits. And destroyed, he'd been raised Catholic. It says that it destroyed the last bits of any Catholic upbringing he'd had. And he decided that humans were, as he put it, merely minor elements in a vast mechanistic process in the struggle for existence. So this is the theory that literary naturalists were conveying through their literature. And it's very important, I would suggest, that it's, you know, our children are reading these books in school. They're considered classics. Mm-hmm. They're assigned in many literature classes, and yet I don't think the public schools are really teaching young people to recognize just not just the literary elements, but what about the philosophical elements that are being conveyed to young minds who are absorbing the worldview along with the story.
Right, and it's very reductionistic to see man as mere matter. And you go on and you explain a little bit about this, which I'm just reminded when we're talking about literary naturalists, how often a lot of their writing is very boring. And you talk about why atheism is boring. And I would say why materialism is especially boring, which just thrills me to bits because we had an encounter, I guess it was a year and a half ago, maybe. Richard Dawkins was in town, and George Gilder was also in town speaking at Discovery Institute that same day. And so what we got to have was this wonderful contrast between the two, where you had George Gilder speaking on intelligent design, on the Israel test, on all these wonderful ideas that were just percolating in his head, and the creative imagination of someone with that sort of foresight and with a mind that assumes design and an author behind the story, right? And then you have Richard Dawkins, who we saw later that night at University of Washington, who was just dry, and even with his characteristic mannerisms and charm, he was frankly very boring. Why is that? Why is the fruitlessness? Well, I you can tell my answer that I think there's something very fertile in seeing the world as designed, and very sterile in seeing it as a product of materialism. Why is that, though, throughout in literature, in music, when we see people with these preconceptions, why does it tend to be so boring?
Yeah, this was something that critics have actually pointed out about literary naturalism. In my book, in Saving Leonardo, I actually quote some literary critics saying this. It's not something I'm, you know, just imposing on them. But there's a professor who says naturalism was boring because it creates dramas which meander and never quite reach a resolution. In other words, the literary naturalists were trying to portray humans as to use a line from Emile Zola, who is a French literary naturalist. He was really the leading theorist of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of his books, he portrays characters who commit murder and adultery, and yet because he's a naturalist, he's trying to be very scientific about this, and he wants to treat the novel as a laboratory for scientific inquiry. He really believed that you could use the novel to, in a sense, investigate human behavior in a very detached, clinical manner, like a scientist picking up specimens with his, you know, with his tweezers and looking at them.
Right.
And that's, in a sense, that almost the tone that you get from many of the literary naturalists. They aimed at a tone that was detached and above all, value-free, because they thought that was required by science. See, no moral analysis. So he portrays adultery and murder and so on without sympathy, without a moral, without any redemption. And in his own words, Emile Zola says, "I was betraying human characters without free will, governed by the inexorable laws of their physical nature. They are human animals, nothing more." Well, the trouble is, portraying humans as animals and nothing more actually made them rather flat characters. It's not easy to flesh out characters who essentially make no decisions, but are just swept along by the social and cosmic forces. They are puppets of fate. There can be no character development when they're helpless victims of their environment.
Right.
And so you can see this in Anton Chekhov, in his dramas. Take his drama, The Three Sisters. The characters talk endlessly through all four acts of the play. They talk about how they're going to leave their provincial home and move back to Moscow, but they never can bring themselves to do it. And what Chekhov is trying to show is that we are trapped by our social customs, by our genetic temperament, by our family. We're trapped by all of these things, and we cannot really make a move. We're like flies caught in a web. It does make for characters, those who are most consistent in portraying a naturalistic view through literature, do not succeed in making very exciting literature. But I think our critique of that has to go even further, and that is that it's not true to life. I mean, human beings do make moral decisions. People are not merely pawns of outside forces, to use Dreiser's term. We do make decisions. A lot of the drama of human life comes through that. And so even though naturalism was often considered an offshoot of realism, it's really not realistic enough.
Exactly, which many people don't understand. And they also don't understand, which I find this very interesting, how Darwin wasn't really considered accepted science, you write, until the 1930s. But the ideas of evolution, of a different sort of evolution that was actually spiritualized, although not always connected to God by the Romantics, was around far before Darwin. Can you talk a little bit about the Romantics and their strange sort of teleological evolution that fit in with their own writing and arts in that way?
Yeah, I'm going to ask that because most people, you know, they really peg evolution to Darwin, and they don't realize that evolutionary thought in its broader forms around 200 years before Darwin,
right,
because it started with Hegel. Up until Hegel, the universe was thought to be essentially static, cyclical.
Right.
What happens today is going to happen again tomorrow. And by the way, the parentheses, that idea is coming back now that Christianity is losing its hold on culture. I read it yesterday, and I got a children's book from my son from the library,
mm-hmm,
and it was promoting that view, that what happens today is going to happen again, and it is in the context of a story. And I thought, aha, there we are, back to the cyclical, static view of history. But at any rate, it is, and again, it was through a novel, a children's, in this case, a young person's, young adult novel. Anyway, Hegel was the first one to suggest that the universe is progressing in time, it unfolds in stages from simple to complex. But this was not by any means a naturalistic view of evolution. It was an almost pantheistic view of evolution because he said his term was the absolute spirit or absolute mind, which unfolds dialectically over history. So in a sense, it was a spiritualized evolution with God as an immanent force within the world that evolves along with the world. And of course, people who already accepted Hegel then did accept Darwin very quickly, but they didn't understand really what he was about. They thought that Darwin could be used to support their teleological version of evolution, and didn't realize that, in fact, his was completely non-teleological. That was part of the whole point of Darwin's theory, was to get rid of any notion of progress or purpose or goal-directedness from the very concept of evolution. So, yeah, there were two really very different concepts of evolution historically, and most people don't realize how long, really. It was not until the 1930s that Darwin became kind of orthodoxy among biologists. Before that, most people held to some notion of directed evolution, God-guided evolution. That's still very popular today, of course. I think if you look at the statistics on who believes in God and who believes in evolution, most people try to put the two together. They are really still holding on to more of the romantic notion, romantic as in capital R, romantic from romanticism. The romanticist view of evolution is still very, very common today, I think.
Right. One day we will progress far beyond this and achieve greater and higher ideals and purposes.
And I think that the new book out from the Discovery Institute follows, too, on God and evolution is addressing this. Can we hold on to Darwin and God at the same time? How contradictory are there? Of course, in Saving Leonardo, what I do is I show how this sort of pantheistic notion of evolution was spelled out in the most obvious is abstract art. Abstract art. Kandinsky is often considered the first abstract artist. And he wrote a booklet that proved incredibly influential among artists. It was called Concerning the Spiritual in Art. And he explained how his pantheistic worldview affected his decision to paint abstract art. What he decided was, if you wanted to counter materialism, which is what he wanted to do, he wanted to get rid of scientific materialism and naturalism and all those reductive worldviews, he decided the way to do that was to get rid of material objects. If you got rid of material objects in your painting and painted abstract instead, then you would draw the mind away from the material world and from that materialism that was so embedded in, and you would draw the mind up to a spiritual reality. So he really believed that abstract art, as he put it, would be one of the most powerful agents of the spiritual realm in our world. So you see, you can't even understand trends, say, in art and literature without understanding the ideas that were driving it. And that's what Saving Leonardo is about, is helping people to see, where did these ideas come from? You know, when an artist comes up with abstract art, general public looks at these paintings and says, I don't get it. You know, where did this come from? Or, my five-year-old sister could do this. You know?
Right.
And sometimes they don't take a lot of skill, but what you need to do is go behind it and say, what were the ideas driving this? And you have to know that Kandinsky was very much expressing this kind of spiritualized evolution and hoping that by painting non-objective or abstract art, he could somehow reach a spiritual level and enable his viewers to reach some new spiritual level.
Right. Well, it's all very fascinating. I regret to say that we are definitely out of time for this interview, but thank you so much, Nancy, for being with us and for your wonderful new book out now, Saving Leonardo.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Annika. I really appreciate it.
For ID the Future, this is Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.